Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, in honor of the late Gore Vidal, we revisit his thoughts on the state of politics. Then, Swift Boats and Willie Horton, can negative ads determine an election? On July 31st, the world lost another of the greats. Gore Vidal was one of the most prolific and insightful writers of our time. He wrote numerous books, plays, and essays that reached across politics, literature, art, and history. His flair for language and biting wit allowed us to look beyond the headlines so that we could laugh at our societal foibles. Born Eugene Luther Gore Vidal, he was the grandson of Oklahoma Senator Thomas P. Gore and grew up in political circles. He's a cousin of former President Al Gore and ran for office twice. But his writing was where he made his name. I interviewed Gore Vidal in his Hollywood Hills home in October 2008. One of the interesting things about the interview with Gore Vidal was that as long as the tape was on, he had one persona. So I might ask him a question and he would snap at me. He would say, well, that's a stupid question in one way or the other. But as soon as the tape went off, it was a different person altogether. He didn't want me to leave. He wanted to talk about his art. He wanted me to go around his house and look at his paintings so he could tell me the stories of them all. He showed me photographs of his friends, and most of them had died, but he wanted to tell me about them. And it was very clear that there were two Gore Vidals, one who was on when the tape was recording, and one when you turned the tape off. You've been watching politics for a long time. You're a historian, you're a novelist, you're an essayist, social critic, you've run for office. If you could look at where we've come as a nation, what would you say as an assessment?
I'd say that Darwin was wrong.
So we're not evolving?
No, we're dissolving, which is not a good thing to do.
What makes you say that?
You see no real difference between George Washington and George W. Bush? You think one follows upon the other logically?
I certainly don't.
I asked you a question. There it is.
Maybe the better way to look at it is, how did we get here? What's your sense of that?
Through the world's worst educational system for the people at large. We never thought education was important. We thought the people who read books and thought thoughts were just silly nerds. And we don't like nerds. Everybody's a real guy, you know, out there fighting and playing around. So we raised a nation of hicks. And now it's come home to roost. Our people aren't bright enough to compete in the real world. We thought as long as we could blow up everybody that we were all powerful. Well, we weren't. First of all, they figured out how to blow us up, so I don't think we're ahead in the famous arms race.
Is it what is included in the educational system, or is it another aspect?
Well, that everything is excluded from the educational system except education. It's mostly propaganda. My small expertise with American history. I've been writing it for years. So I check every high school textbook on U.S. history. It's mostly propaganda. No wonder the kids find it boring. Very boring. Because it isn't true, and they know that it is not true.
And yet, we have adults who think that it's true.
I don't give a damn about them.
But they're the ones that vote.
Well, I'm not running for office, so why should I care? It's too late to train them. I talk to very educated, very affluent people I get to meet all the time, and they're beautifully got up, and the ladies have jewels, and the gentlemen have everything gentlemen like, and they don't know who Benjamin Franklin was. And I try, and I used to drop an occasional reference, just hoping it would somehow play. It doesn't play. And that's sort of the end of any attempt at a civilization, which I hoped by the time I got to be my age would have been a major task of the United States of America. I was in World War II for 3 years. I got out of the Army in 1946, and I thought, now I'm going to enter a great world. This is when the U.S. develops as a civilization. And we can't just go around saying, you know, that because we have some good jazz singers or jazz players, and that's going to be the equal of Mozart. It isn't. It's wonderful. All the world likes jazz, but That's not white America, which is what I belong to. What I belong to hasn't really caught on terribly well.
You mentioned George Bush and compare him to George Washington, and clearly there's a vast distinction between the two of them. But over time, you've criticized many of our politicians. You've criticized FDR, you've criticized Truman, you've criticized...
Well, I think you belong to the American school. No fault of yours. It's the way you were born and brought up.
Oh, you can't be negative. Goodness me, we must be affirmative and look on the bright side. The sun is shining. This attitude has got us with no economy, has got us defeated, really in two wars simultaneously, which is the trick of the week. I'm rather pro-military, having been born at West Point in the cadet hospital. West Point is to me where everything begins. Is this a good thing to think? I don't know, but it's the way I think. And we failed everything. Everything. And unfortunately, we've raised a couple of generations now who are too simple-minded to know that we are failures. It drives me crazy when McCain gets out there. And everybody who talks to him has to say what a great hero he is. Being a prisoner of war is not heroism. It's bad luck. And it used to be you'd be court-martialed for it if they ever retrieved you from the enemy. So he's made a political career out of being a false hero. He's not a hero. My generation, and I'm more Second World War, and he was more the Korean War, or whatever it was that he was mucking around in. Well, our heroes were people like Audie Murphy. I don't know now, I bet that name is just a clinker out there on the airwaves. That kid was a hero, and deeply honored by his fellow soldiers and by the American people back of them. We were a real country, and we aren't any such thing now.
How do you define real country like we were then versus how we are now?
Well, we hear from all the gangsters who run us. I mean, we're run by thieves. These are people who steal money. And the people who steal money and so on want to play, oh, they'll play the patriotic note because the dum-dums won't know the difference. So they say, well, we are the greatest. They go on for hours about this. These are people who've done nothing but steal all their lives and should be ashamed of themselves. Shame is not an American vice or capacity, and that's a pity. No, we had it made as of 1946. We were the number one in the world militarily, economically, in making up things. And then it all went away. Everybody else could imitate us, and did it better than we. And here we are at the end of the road, pretending it's morning in America. I liked Reagan. I didn't know him very well, but he was a pleasant fellow. And I thought that's when he totally lost me. I said, will you tell any lie in order to be admired by what you must think are the dum-dums out there? Politics is a dogfight in any country that has elections, certainly, and that's what we have. And the fact that it is a dogfight is not necessarily a bad thing, which you can't say it's a science. You can't teach it as if it were one. That was the triumph of the age of science in the 20th century. Everything's a science. Just come in here, come in the lab. And I'll show you how a revolution starts. Well, you put a little bit of Karl Marx here. Don't put too much, don't put too much. The tubes will burn out. Most of our educational system was to keep people from knowing things, particularly about the United States, which to me is the only political science. It's not a science, but the only politics I would love to have had people learn, because that's our country. Once a year, Purdue, the university, does a study of high school students for the year, and what they liked when they were going through the middle school, the high school, and so forth, what subjects they liked, and what they liked about them. The one subject they hated was American history. Now, it takes genius to destroy that, and if you want to be a conspiracy theorist, which I don't go in for, and I like to think about how silly so many of them are, that's really what it's about. They don't want us to know the history, because if they know the history, they'll know that we might figure out that the country was hijacked from the people. The people are irrelevant. The people are regarded as bloody idiots by the rulers who are there to make them buy things they don't need. And that's the American way of life.
And if you were going to talk about the things in history that you most wish people did know, what would you say those things are?
Well, my first historical novels was called Burr, about Aaron Burr. Most of your listeners will not know who he is, because the schools don't teach him, other than he killed Alexander Hamilton. Not the worst thing he ever did. It is a great history, and the fact that we're not born or brought up with any reverence for it, any fascination with it, as I was. Now, my grandfather was blind, so I had to read to him, and he was for nearly 50 years a U.S. senator, and I used to have to read to him, and so I got a head start on all this. I've been faced for two generations with people who can't read books and don't like to read books and hate to read books and have told that books are for bad people. People who can't make it in the world of showbiz, which is the only important thing on earth. And that it's uphill to try to get them to read a book. It'll make us solve the financial disasters which the thieves have done to us. But you can't call them thieves because that's very unkind, you know. He did give a wonderful music hall to the village. Mm-hmm. He did all that. Such a kind man, happily married to his wife. This is how they get everybody off books. No one's responsible for anything. When it comes to culture, the average American doesn't care because he's been told it's sissy or it's boring. Just don't bother with it.
Do you ultimately look at the voters and say this is really falls upon them?
Well, ultimately it does, yeah. That's if their votes are counted. Now, we have come to a period in which votes are not counted. And elections are stolen. We only have Bush as president because it was stolen in 2000, first election of the presidency. Second one, 2004, stolen again.
Let's talk a little bit about the media.
It's a very small subject. We'll be silent in a minute.
Actually, you've been a media critic for quite some time, too, one of the first. One particular piece you wrote was in response to Newsweek because of a piece they did about Mr. Buckley, whom you've debated. In your sense, they got it all wrong. So give us a sense about what should the media be doing? What's wrong with it?
Well, the people in it probably should retire and, you know, farm or do something honest labor. They're not equipped to do anything. Is anybody in the New York Times equipped to review a new book by me or by Angelou? Who are they to review us? They don't know anything about books.
Well, I don't really like him, you know. He's so negative. Now, I really hate that.
I mean, we've got so many village idiots riding herd, pretending to be this, that, so on.
Is there hope in terms of media? The internet, for example?
Well, why don't you just go to the heart? Who owns it? That is where it all boils down to. And it is owned by... You'll never see a word of criticism about atomic weapons or atomic power in NBC. You never will. Why? NBC is owned by General Electric. General Electric makes most of those weapons, and they don't object to the wars. So if I wanted to go on and chat about how we lost the war, the latest war, in the Middle East, they wouldn't print a word. Because we won it. They announced we won it. They have their own little president, you know. Cockeyed though he may be, that he's rambling around. I'm a wartime president. I'm a wartime president. I'm a wartime president. He's not a wartime president. He's a phony president. He's a president picked by the very wealthy and companies like General Electric.
What about the current candidates? What about Barack Obama?
When he was being attacked as an elitist, oh my God, I can't believe it, an American. He's a snob. He has afternoon tea, probably, when he's not praying to Allah somewhere. I mean, you know, our people are now at the point of idiocy. They can't figure out anything. One thing they have never been able to figure out is the difference between an intelligent person and an unintelligent one. The senator from Arizona is about as dumb as you can get on every subject. But he says, my friends, and I want to tell you this, and this is true because I tell you it's true. Nothing he says parses. Nothing he said makes any sense. But he made everybody accept that he's a great war hero because he got taken captive by the Viet Cong. You see, this is a country where you're allowed to reinvent yourself every 5 minutes. I wrote some very funny things at the time about Richard M. Nixon, who reinvented himself. Everybody thought he could never come back into public life. He said, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. And nobody wanted to kick him around, but he didn't count that as a blessing. And then he comes back and gets to be president. And we've got a lot of big case against him. And, oh, well, you know, the poor guy has suffered for so much. Being accountable for his misdeeds was suffering for no reason. The one sin in America is to call somebody else's scam. Once you do that, you are a bad person. You can tell any lie, and the medium will go along with it. The public will say, oh, yes, that's true. And he's such a nice man, you know. I really like his smile. This is infantilism, and it's no wonder we sank.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. I'm Maria Armudian, and in honor of the late Gore Vidal, we're revisiting one of our conversations with him. So, Barack Obama, I would like to go back to him. You have talked in the past about Republicans talking law and order, and that's really code for controlling minorities. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the fact that we have Barack Obama as a candidate means that we have evolved to some extent? I mean, I know you said Darwin was wrong, but we have a man who is of mixed race, African-American, as our Democratic candidate.
Don't congratulate yourself or white America for his gifts. Through sheer endurance, he has survived. Now look what they're doing to him. They get that prehistoric woman from Alaska to come down and sneer at him. She says, we Americans, we don't like that, do we, in our people? We're for patriotism. Yeah, and so on. And this woman, who doesn't know the alphabet, much less the history of the United States, is taken seriously because that's her scam. His gifts are there in spite of white America.
Yes.
Now, where he is unfamiliar to the general public, and they have reasons to be disturbed by him because they don't understand a damn word he's saying. And why don't they? He's something they never come across. He's an educated man. They don't know how educated people talk. There's something weird about that guy. I don't understand what he's talking about. Well, of course you don't. You have no education at all. And the sooner we get that through our poor noodles, the better off we will be. Because we live in a world where nobody can understand a word we're saying. I've spent much of my life living in Italy, and boy, Italians, who are the kindest people about Americans, in Europe anyway, are mystified by how we came up with Bush for president and this one and that one. I will not give the list of shame on your poor program.
Oh, well, you're welcome to. We'll
no,
take
I
it.
No, I will not. I won't maintain your innocence out there. What you don't know could never hurt you.
So it sounds like your largest criticism is really of the education system. And
well, if you want to boil it down to one thing, yes, you probably could, because everything goes back to that. But I have many ideas for changing it, and I've written a great deal about what you ought to teach in the schools.
Nobody knows.
I often said when I was a politician upstate New York, and I had a lot of young audiences who voted for me, and I said, why is it that I'm not a lover of children, but I have never met a stupid, boring 6-year-old, and I've never met an interesting 16-year-old. Well, wow, the whole hall they'd start arguing for the next 5 hours. It struck a nerve. My line was, you could start by changing the curriculum, what you're going to teach them. Nobody knows. And 1 year they've got to know more trigonometry, and they find that very difficult, and then they must. American history is never taught. It's too hot. It's blazing hot. You're going to have to explain 1846. Your audience doesn't know what I mean, but that is when we seized from Mexico, California, where we are now sitting, and I'm quite happy we got it. But, we also got the animosity of the entire Hispanic American population of the Western Hemisphere. So if we find them a little irritable and intractable, it could well be they remember that. We don't, because we're too important to remember anything. We know, each of us is born, as at birth, knows the names of 8 detergents and is forever slave to them. When I'm talking to the ACLU now, and there are 4 or 5 young men, Hispanic, came up to thank me because I talked about 1846, the Mexican War, and they had never heard a gringo ever admit that there had been such a thing. Other than we'd been viciously attacked. We're always viciously attacked everywhere we look. They're enemies, they're after Kenneth. Why? Because we're white, and we're rich, and we're extremely fat. And they are so jealous of us. We are so conceited and slow-witted that we can't survive much longer. All we had was a lot of money. We had a rich continent to play with. And we won 2 great wars with a president that is hated by every Republican, Franklin Roosevelt. Whom I knew, rather, what I knew his widow, Eleanor, quite well. He was our great blessing. I try to explain this to the dum-dums. Oh, now you see, he was a communist. Communist. How do you know he's a communist? Well, he was a communist. Well, he let them vote, you know, and that's how they start to attack black people. I said, well, he didn't. He evolved. He needed them for his imperial wars, and they did proper duty. They were proper citizens of the United States and should take part in all of the goodness of our land. Roosevelt was the first one who saw some potential for the citizens of this republic, and he was better than we deserved. One of the things that is wrong with George W. Bush, other than the fact that you couldn't educate him, there was just no way of getting anything into that empty head, he believed his grandfather, Prescott Bush, who was a fifth-rate senator, and anti-Roosevelt to the point of hysteria. I mean, people really would froth at the mouth if you mentioned the president, because he was doing things for the people, and the people don't goddamn well deserve it. And we're here to stop them. We don't want to spoil their moral fiber. These are people who could not look after themselves without a trust fund. And yet they were very strong on what the people out there should do. And I think one of the developments in my lifetime was as that terrible group of country club folk lost power, they became more venomous. We have no sense of who we are. And all we had was the Republic, and the Republic went. By the time Bush finished 2 years in office, he had got rid of habeas corpus, he'd got rid of the great gift that England gave us, which was, as they were leaving, the great document Magna Carta, which contained habeas corpus and due process of law. Everything we get is secondhand. We weren't bright enough to think of it ourselves. And yet we get a president, a know-nothing president, and he wants to get rid of everything, too, because we don't want regulation, because capitalism, he doesn't even know what capitalism is. It's spelling your name with capital letters, I suppose.
Well, you've actually frequently said that we have socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor.
We have free enterprise for the poor and socialism for the rich. The rich get all the floating money around and they grab every penny of it in the interest of civilization, and then free enterprise for the poor. The poor can starve as they like. It's Protestantism gone wrong. It was always the Protestant view that if you were a good person, you had money. You're a bad person. You didn't have money because God didn't like you. Nyeh, nyeh, nyeh.
So let's reflect on your political history. You've run for office, and you have been a political critic for quite some time. Suppose you became a congressman or a senator. What would you do?
Well, it's what you're allowed to do. And I was inspired to think about it. I'm thinking about it right now, because I've been asked, would I go for the House. And it's not my dream to be a professional politician. I'm far, far, far too old. And secondly, you know, my life is beautifully complete. I don't need a title. Is for someone who's accomplished nothing. The rest of us have our names, and that's what we have.
And so what would you do had you become a politician?
Oversight committees in the House. I'm a great friend of Dennis Kucinich. I sat stunned when Dennis started to read off the articles of impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. He should have been given the Nobel Prize for that. And it's still on the table, as they say. I do more of that, investigative. I mean, that's what the Congress is for.
And legislative, of course.
Well, you only legislate to try and correct something that's wrong. I suppose you can be one of those people, those congressmen, who are always rushing into the well of the House to make sure that Arbor Day is not neglected this year.
And in terms of legislation that you think would make a difference?
You see this nicely lit room?
Oh, yeah.
I've got all these paintings, which are normally very expensive to light them properly. This is all done because I wanted to light the paintings. I converted the entire house. Every bit of energy in this house comes from solar panels. And it was a joy to get myself off the oil grid, which I'm off of. You'll always find a way in an emergency to pull out the wiring somehow, but we hope one gets back on. Solar energy for everybody who wants it, and most people do, but the state is against it.
So solar energy, reforming the education system.
Isn't that enough work for one congressman?
I think that would be pretty profound. So what do you think developed your thinking the most?
One, I would be the last person on earth to ask myself such a question or to think about it. The problem with most Americans, I don't want to sound totally anti-American, but now you're making me, they never stop talking about themselves. Back in the 40s, it was, when the war was over there, it was their analysis. Everybody's being analyzed. Everybody thought he was interesting. They couldn't stop talking about themselves. And I feel so embarrassed in Europe, particularly when I travel from country to country. There'd be the American tourists, mostly very nice people, very dutiful about educating themselves, since the schools hadn't done it here. They were trying to make up. And I did my best to help out. They couldn't stop talking about themselves. Well, my car, let me tell you about, I'm able to get so many ounces of Vaseline out of chicken fat, you know, or whatever. And they'd go on and on. And the Italians, you know, are not boring people. They're very polite. You see, they were appalled. They wanted to talk about Leonardo da Vinci. They wanted to talk about Abraham Lincoln. Well, they're like me because I wrote books about all those people. And they read the books, which were translated into Italian. Go to a bookstore and see how many books have been translated from Italian into English.
Since you mentioned Abraham Lincoln, he tried to suspend habeas corpus as well.
Well, he was in a war that the nation was falling apart. And the only way he could do it was to suspend habeas corpus. He didn't do it, as Bush did, out of malice. Because he hates people who can read books, educated people, authorities on things. He hates them. And his old regime hates them. Look at Cheney's face and you realize this is a prune, you know, steeped in hatred.
The politics of hate.
Well, it's been governing us. I think most Americans figured that one out.
I wonder also the politics of fear, the politics of hate and the politics of fear.
They're jumbled together. Roosevelt said in 1933 when he became president, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And he organized a nation. I took a look at Harry Truman, who was one of our really bad guys. Though he's such a nice little guy, and he loved his daughter so much, and so on. Yes, yes, yes. He was a cornball, but he was a malicious little thing. His inaugural, he said, "We're faced by monumental enemies everywhere we look, to our left and to our right. There they are." He was getting us ready for the Cold War, which he was about to launch. He loved the Cold War, and that's what wrecked us. That's how we didn't get a civilization. We were too busy arming. The Russians are coming. And that's all he could say. That's all he could do.
Let's talk for a moment about language and how it's changed.
Well, it's more and more meager now. There are fewer and fewer words that we can use. The thing that made the country, those who really complain are usually the ones who don't have enough words to explain themselves. Think of themselves as old Americans, so they speak a god-awful English. That is most of the Caucasian Americans of a certain age. They hate the foreigners. They don't want to talk Spanish. They don't want this. They don't want that. They're just irritated by everything. I think it's a great help. But then I've always been bilingual.
And also, you've talked about how languages, even words in our own English language, have taken on different meanings.
Well, I'm fascinated by etymology, as any good writer is, which is the source of words. Why we use this word and not that one? As we have so many, you know, synonyms. Too many, I sometimes think, which makes it very easy for illiterates to think they're talking English when they're just gabbling.
And the words such as liberal and conservative have changed.
Well, they're meaningless. That's too much for unfilled heads to deal with.
Is there one, or are there two or three, that you feel are the biggest contributions you've made? What are those?
Well, if I had the power of assigning books to be read by my fellow countrymen, I would assign a book called Creation. And it took me many years to write, and it's about how one man, had he lived to be 70, could have known the Buddha, Confucius, my favorite, Socrates, Pericles, and I invented such a character. The book is a huge success all over Europe, and it's getting an audience here. Nobody pushes it because who wants to know about somebody called Zoroaster? I mean, but I get more and more, and from friends of mine who should know better, who are better educated than I never went to a university. They all went to universities and they don't know anything about anything. They don't want to know anything.
Mr. Vidal, thank you. If you'd like to hear the entire interview with Gore Vidal, we'll be posting it next week at www.scholarcircle.org. From Willie Horton to the Swift Boat Veterans, what is the impact of negative advertising? Stay tuned.
Dear Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? Can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells. while you pave the road to hell? What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away?
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. With the presidential election 3 months away, some swing states are already drowning in political ads, many of them negative, some of them deceptive. Negative ads are certainly not new in American politics, but some have been quite potent. This 1988 ad, for example, was thought to be one deciding factor in the election of George H.W. Bush.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
What is the impact of negativity on election outcomes? What is its long-term effect on democracy? We have three experts with us now. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the university's Annenberg Public Policy Center, and the author and co-author of 16 books, including Packaging the Presidency, Echo Chamber, Rush Limbaugh and the Conservative Media Establishment, Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation, and Spiral of Silence. Jamieson also helped to create factcheck.org and flackcheck.org, nonpartisan websites that monitor deception and confusion in U.S. politics. Michael Franz is professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads, and co-author of Interest Groups in American Campaigns, The New Face of Electioneering, The Persuasive Power of Political Advertising, and Campaign Advertising in American Democracy. Also with us is John Geer. He is professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University and author of several books, including In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns, Nominating Presidents, An Evaluation of Voters in Primaries, and From Tea Leaves to Opinion Polls, Politicians, Information, and Leadership. So welcome to the three of you. So glad to have you here. I'd like to start by putting the campaign into a historic context, the rhetoric, the advertising. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, I know that you had called the Republican primary among one of the meanest you had seen. What about the general election?
Because we're going to have unprecedented amounts of third-party advertising in the general election, I think it's predictable historically to say the level of attack will be driven up, simply because third-party advertising tends to be more attack-driven, and it's reasonable to suppose that the level of deception is going to increase as a result. So because of the wash of money in the system, the amounts are going to be greater than they've been in the past of both attack and deception.
Now, when you look historically, are you seeing important trends in terms of what you called in one of your books, dirty politics, in terms of the negativity? Are there cycles? Is it getting worse?
You know, I don't like the word negative because it conflates dirty, illegitimate discourse with legitimate attack, and there's a purpose for legitimate attack in politics. If it's fair, accurate, and relevant to governance, it offers important distinctions between candidates, and that's the basis for voting. And so the question, you know, becomes, is there a higher level of attack, and is the attack useful or not? And do you reach a high enough level of attack at which you just simply have crowded out the advocacy and you don't know what you're voting for? And a major concern this year is that we may have such a high level of attack that we will have not had the advocacy needed to know what you're casting a vote for.
John Geer.
I agree with Kathleen. I mean, we were going to see unprecedented amounts of attacks and negativity. Well, I actually favor the term attack, but everybody talks about it being negative. I think that it's predictable not only because of the third-party ads, which Kathleen mentioned, but you also have two political parties that continue to polarize, and that polarization gives grist for the attack mills. And in addition, you have two candidates that have some flaws. I mean, Barack Obama has a mixed record to run on, and Mitt Romney certainly has some things he has to defend. And so you mix all that together along with third parties and the money that they have, and we're just going to see a huge amount of attack advertising in this campaign. And it becomes really important as Kathleen just suggested, that we find ways to try to adjudicate these ads, the ones that actually provide, you know, reasonable claims and ones that don't.
Now, both of you have looked throughout American history at these ads, and there have been long periods where we've had some pretty scary, some pretty nasty ads. How do you compare what you're seeing now with what we've seen? We had the Daisy ad. That was kind of a famous one. We had the Willie Horton ad. What are you seeing now, and what do you expect to see, John Geer?
Well, I'm sure both Michael and Kathleen, we've all been watching and seeing these ads. I actually haven't seen anything that's really just been crazily out there that has been so negative that's been off the charts. I mean, we haven't had a Swift boat. We haven't had Willie Horton. Doesn't mean we won't. I've been surprised by the amount of negativity, but I've been surprised by how both candidates at this point are producing pretty mainstream, not very exciting ads, with the sole exception maybe being the America the Beautiful ad, where Romney was singing off-key. So I've been a little surprised by that. I'm hoping that there's a little bit more creativity as we move towards November.
Professor Franz.
Well, I think that the interesting thing from my perspective on this time around is what will be the share of outside spending, as Kathleen and John both mentioned, of outside spending in the air war this time around. This is the first election where both major candidates in a long time haven't accepted public funding for the general election, and that's going to ramp up the amount of money that's being spent, and then the outside spending is going to also be significant. And so the cost overall of the campaign will be high, incredibly high. But also the presence of third-party spending will be the highest it's been in a long time. Historically, in the last number of cycles or elections, we haven't really seen the absence of third-party spending. In 2004, we saw plenty with Move On and the Swift Boats, and in 2000, there was a fair amount of issue advocacy in the Gore-Bush contest. But this time around, with the presence of super PACs and such a close affiliation with the candidates that these super PACs have, this is going to be an unprecedented election from that perspective.
Michael Franz, your project, the Wesleyan Media Project, had a particular number, a 70% number of messages being negative. And up to this point, it said the last presidential election, 2008, was really almost the reverse, maybe even more positive. I think it said 91% positive. What does that really mean for us from this point forward?
Well, you know, those numbers were about the presidential primary election to date back in through the beginning of May. And what was really striking about the 2008 primary election between Obama and Clinton, and even on the Republican side, was how positive their own campaign ads were. To the extent that the candidates went after each other, it was through their surrogates on cable news and through other areas, that their ads themselves were very promotional. And that just is the complete opposite this time around. And so if the flip in the amount of negativity from 2008 to 2012 is that distinct in the primary election, I can only imagine what it will mean for the level of negativity in the general election.
Now, I'm going to want to go back to the outside spending and the super PACs that we're seeing now, but there's something, Kathleen Hall Jameson, you mentioned I'd like to get into, which is you distinguish negative policy from other kinds of manipulations, mistruths, or negative on character. What are you seeing now, and then what are the effects of each of these?
Well, I mean, we could spend hours talking about what the academic community does and does know about the effect of advertising. And I think, you know, my bottom line summary about what we know about effects is the academic community is divided about what it thinks it knows, and many of the findings are largely inconclusive. One of the things that we know from content analysis, which is not an effects measure, it's simply looking at content, is that if you looked at the top four spending third-party groups through the Wisconsin primary, so that's basically the pre-Iowa through Wisconsin period, what you see is, looking at dollars spent, not number of ads aired, more than half contained at least one deceptive claim as called out by the major fact checkers. We then looked at the C4 groups. They don't have to disclose their donors. The other third-party groups, the super PACs, the PACs, the issue groups, the parties do have to disclose donors. The groups that didn't disclose donors, and we looked at the top four spending groups through June, and what we found was an even higher number of dollars spent in ads that contained at least one deception. And what that tells us is, I think, that when you don't have to disclose who's funding, you're a little freer with what you do with claims about the external world. And I think one of the concerns this year is that It is that we don't know how to hold people accountable for messages when we don't know who they are, and we increasingly don't know who they are.
Now, you had said in another interview that media don't actually have to air the ads that are coming from outside parties if they find some inaccuracies. Is that true?
Yes. FCC regulations require that a candidate ad, if the candidate is a bona fide candidate for federal office, and there are similar stipulations for a state candidate, if the candidate appears in the ad, with few exceptions, the station has to take the ad. They can even know that it's blatantly deceptive, and they still have to take the ad, and they have to air the ad. However, if a third-party group comes with an ad, they have no comparable right to air. And as a result, television stations can say, on the clear-cut, blatant inaccuracies, not the gray area calls. I wouldn't recommend that they do it on the gray area calls. But on the clear-cut inaccuracies, they clearly have the right to insist on accuracy before they air, and they don't have to air at all. We've got a project running which asks individuals to email their stations, come to flackcheck.org to do that, FLACK.org, urging them to check the accuracy of ads before they air, check with the fact checkers. We've got a deception log on the Flack Check site to help them, and also urging stations to fact check on air and online the gray areas, the things that may be misleading but not blatantly and clearly inaccurate. Stations have that right. They know that we don't know that, and as a result, because they get more money for third-party ads than candidate ads, they have an incentive to take them and take them uncritically. We'd like to change that dynamic.
Michael Franz, let's bring you back in terms of these different kinds of negative advertising. Is this similar to what you're seeing in terms of attack on character or mistruths?
Well, yeah, I mean, Kathleen is at the forefront of being able to measure the content in that way, and so our project doesn't look at sort of that per se. We rely on them, but it's absolutely true that what we're seeing is, in certain circumstances, the outside groups doing the more of the personal attacks and attacking more on character, and that's an issue that raises concerns for people, and it's not entirely unpredictable given the fact that they don't have to disclose oftentimes. But it is evident this time around, and we're probably going to see more of it.
Michael Franz, one of the things you looked at that I thought was quite interesting was persuasive effects. Like, are these ads persuasive? And it sounded like there's a very small persuasive effect. Why do they spend so much money on them?
Well, it's an arms race. You have to spend money to keep up with the other side, because if you don't spend money, the other side will, and then, of course, you'll probably lose. And so you spend a lot of money kind of keeping up with the Joneses, and at the end of the day, you try to carve out a little bit more of an advantage, a little bit better of a message, and hope that pushes you over the top. Now, there's definitely a difference in effect up and down the ticket. The presidential elections, where a lot is determined by the what we call the fundamentals, versus House races or Senate races, where there can be a bit more of a campaign effect. And so the size of a persuasive effect will vary, but it's not significantly large in all of those cases most of the time. And so we're really talking about trying to win the marginal voter, win the undecideds, tip the election when it's close. And you have to spend a lot of money to do that because your competitor is doing the same thing.
John Gear.
Well, as Kathleen mentioned earlier, and Michael's kind of alluded to as well, the academic literature on effects is certainly split. And we have an additional problem in this campaign because basically there's 7 or 8%, maybe high as 10, as low as 5, that's undecided. And of that, really only interested in about 20% of the states where there's battleground. And so we don't have precise enough measures in national polls to be able to pick up any kinds of effects here. So there's going to be a lot of uninformed speculation. And one thing that I've decided to do along with the YouGov people, which is internet polling, we've launched this thing called the Vanderbilt YouGov Ad Rating Project, where we ask a representative sample of Americans, 600 with an oversample of pure independents, what they think about various ads. And, in fact, we can assess the movement that these ads have for those 600 people so that we can see if there's any change among undecideds, for example, towards Romney or towards Obama. Because one thing we need, just like with Kathleen's gathering of the content analysis and trying to assess deception and gathering all that data, we need information. So, for example, people were making comments about Obama's ad last week about it was a minute spot where he looked into the camera called The Choice, and it was kind of a soft contrast ad and lots of speculation that it moved independent voters. Well, our data suggests, no, that's just not true. It's not the case. And so having some hard evidence to try to sort through these matters, whether it be public opinion surveys or whether it be content analysis or be the Wesley Media Project, which is a fabulous undertaking that Michael's involved with, we need this kind of evidence to be able to get a handle on what's going on, especially with this kind of flood of advertising and speculation about their effects.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, let's bring you back in here for a couple of reasons. You've argued in some of your writing about how to build an informed electorate. A lot of political scientists have looked at these political ads as being kind of the primary source of starting the information game, but a lot of them are very visceral.
They are, but they also have a lot of substantive content. And so if you look across the history of the presidency, overall, the content of ads is a digestive version of the content of speeches. And the content of ads forecasts at least a good part of the content of debates. So ads can perform a useful digestive function as long as one isn't in the process absorbing information that's inaccurate. But there's inaccurate information in speeches, and there's inaccurate information in debates, too. The difference is ads have an additional capacity to persuade because they have a visual track, an audio track. They can put resonant music under it, and you can't do all of that in a debate or a speech.
So they're getting, in essence, in 30 seconds, a kind of composite of what somebody might have said in a speech.
Yeah, I mean, the ad that John alludes to, the choice ad, is essentially digesting the substantive, serious attack that Obama is making on Romney and then laying out in a general term what the Obama alternative is. Now, Romney would frame that differently, and I assume when they move to a higher level of advocacy in that campaign, they will. Well, let me go back to an earlier question, though. When we were running the rolling cross-sectional analysis of the National Anabolic Election Survey in 2008, we were able to show that differentials in spending can move perceptions of who you're going to vote for. And I think it's important not to lose track of the fact that differences in money are always going to be a factor underlying the question, what's the effect of the advertising? If you assume that the ads are comparably good on either side, there is a net advantage to the side that spends more, and that gave Obama an advantage on some of the messages they drove home against McCain. He would have won anyway. But what we showed was in the Obama victory book that I co-authored with Kate Kensky and Bruce Hardy that in units of 100 gross rating points differentials, you could show differences in impact given the best controls that you can put in place. And they're always less than ideal. The limitations of our methodology are really severe in answering this question.
So given the big differential that we see today, which is that the super PACs are largely in Romney's favor and the billionaires are largely in Romney's favor, leaving the Obama campaign sort of scrambling, it sounds like what you're saying is it could make or break this election.
In a close election with comparably competent teams with messages, money differentials could make a difference, not simply in the focus that you were addressing earlier, shifting the undecided, but also in your capacity to mobilize those who might not otherwise vote for you. What we're seeing with the Obama campaign is a concentrated effort to increase the percent of the black and Hispanic population that gets to the polls. Those are mobilizing messages in advertising. Those aren't trying to shape voters who are undecided.
Michael Franz.
Well, there's that, and then there's also everything that goes on in the campaign as well. So there's an ability or at least an opportunity for, say, Obama, who might be outspent, to make up some of that difference in lost votes, perhaps, from being out advertised by out-mobilizing on the ground. And that's one of the things that the Obama campaign is working very, very hard on, is trying to use as much new technology as they possibly can to get out every possible vote and to reach every possible voter off the air. And we're seeing a lot more internet advertising, a lot more social media outreach. So even though, you know, all else being equal, the super PACs could move the vote 2-3 percentage points nationally, perhaps, or in key markets or key states, Obama will try to mitigate that with everything else that happens in campaigns. So that's where you get this competitive one-for-one in terms of trying to, you know, reach as many people as possible.
Professor Geer, let's bring you back in. And I also wanted to hear your argument about democracy needing some of this negativity.
Well, let me first just make the comment on the money and then go to the argument about negativity and democracy just briefly. I think that Michael's right that Obama's had, because he didn't face a tough primary, he's been able to get an organization together, and so that may balance some of the money. It's also true that a year ago, everybody assumed Obama would have more money than Romney, and that's changed pretty quickly. And so it's possible that the Democrats could tap into a lot of different fundraisers to close the perceived gap right now. I think money matters, and the findings that Kathleen talks about make perfect sense and certainly seem reasonable. But I'm not so sure that at the end of the day, the money won't be pretty even. As for democracy and negativity, basically, and it was kind of alluded to earlier by Kathleen, that, you know, attacks are part and parcel of making a decision. We need to know the downside of candidates. We need to know the problems facing them. We didn't need to know whether Bain really was a good thing for Romney and suggested he'd be a good president. We need to know what Obama's been doing. And that takes a back and forth, and that needs an exchange. And if we had only positive ads, we'd have misleading information, because candidates are very good at telling you how moderate they are and how reasonable and how smart. We need the corrective of negative information and attacks. Sometimes they go too far, that's certainly true, but this country was founded in some sense on attacks. I mean, the Declaration of Independence was an attack. It was an attack on King George. The Constitution was founded with the Anti-Federalists going full bore against the Constitution. The end result was the Bill of Rights. So democracy has to have negativity, and it has to have attack, and sometimes excessive attacks are a problem, but without it, we'd be in serious trouble.
I want to also look at the mass media and would like to bring Kathleen Hall Jamieson back to talk about this a bit. Now, there are three aspects of this, and you can take all three of them or take a part of them, whichever you'd like. I know you've looked at all three. One is about how traditional mass media cover campaigns, and you've looked at this through the potential effect of making people more cynical. The other piece is that since you've written that book, mass media have become more polarized. And you've written a bit about that with the echo chamber, like the echo chamber effect. And the final thing is the internet, which works in with that, but also the fact-checking of everything. And on the reverse, getting to use something like factcheck.org or flackcheck.org. What are the effects of these?
Let me try to wrap them into a new media scenario. There's a team at MIT and a team working with the Sunlight Foundation that are developing applications that you can download into your handheld devices that would hold the handheld up when you hear or see an ad. It would pick up the audio signal under the ad, match it to the signal in the database, automatically load onto your handheld, and now here's the answer to your question, the best of the available fact-checking on those claims in that ad, the sourcing, as best the journalistic community has been able to find it, to those behind the ads, and then give you links that you can explore further in order to get the backup information for the fact-checking to see if you agree with it, see the disagreements across the fact-checkers where they exist, and also source back to who these individuals are who are funding the ads. We're dealing in a world, in other words, in which a new capacity may be entering the electoral sphere. I don't know if it's going to be there and fully functional in time for the general election, but I think it's very exciting. In a polarized world, most people who are locked inside their own media enclaves, and that is a smaller percent of the population than we think it is on most days, are not likely to be exposed to the information on the other side unless they're watching debates, which gives them the opportunity to see the candidates in a contrastive situation. We need to find a way, as enclaving environments are more and more accessible because you've got them on the web as well as in partisan cable, et cetera, to increase the likelihood that there is at least exposure to the other side. And that's what's potentially exciting to me about this new application.
So the question would be then, would people learn about the application and would they go to that much effort given general political behavior of American citizens? What's your knee-jerk reaction to that? And then we'll pass it to the others.
I think any use would be better than what we have right now because it would increase access that we have trouble getting to. When I see an ad, unless I go to my computer or my handheld and check with the fact-checking sites and go to all of them and then check with Sunlight Foundation or TRIDA or Center for Responsive Politics to find out what we know about donors, I can't do what this application will potentially let me do within a minute. And so the question is, how much of the barrier to doing this has been time? We don't have a lot of it. Most of us have other lives. And can we create an incentive structure that says it's so time-free that you can almost do this instantaneously and make it part of our media routine? If so, I think we can increase the numbers dramatically. If not, we'll stay with the problem we have right now. People who watch news aren't likely to be the ones who are most influenced by the ad.
Michael Franz, I'm going to bring you in first, and I wanted to get your response to whether this is something that people would actually use given typical behavior of American citizens, but also you've looked at that people generally lean on their emotions in cases like this. How do these two comport with one another?
Well, in terms of the likelihood that citizens, you know, use these resources, I think that we have to take a bit of an optimistic view on this, and we have to sort of look to the potential that this can bring about. My big thing is that the effect of super PAC spending and the effect of outside spending can be mitigated significantly if people just took ownership over the messages that they chose to listen to and the information that they chose to believe. And it could be as simple, I know it takes a little time and these applications are going to change that, but it could be as simple as saying, I'm going to write down on a piece of paper who the sponsor of this ad is in the Senate race that I'm in, and I'm going to look it up and see if I can find out any information about this group, and if I can't find any information about this group, I'm not going to believe the message. Democracy requires a bit of responsibility, and it's often the case that people rely on their party or don't care at all in terms of how they make decisions, but I think in terms of mitigating the effect of this outside spending, it requires us to be a little bit more interactive with our political responsibilities. So I remain optimistic that that can take hold, and if we talk a lot about it, and if we teach about it, and if we tell people that this is an important decision every time they go out and vote, maybe a culture can change over the course of time. And yes, people do rely on their emotions, and they do rely on information that fits their predispositions, but that doesn't mean that people aren't able to change their mind, that they're not open to new viewpoints, that they can't be persuaded. I think we just have to look towards a political system where people can feel like that they should look up this information, that they should take their choices seriously, and that they should discount information that they either don't believe or they don't know where it's from. And that alone doesn't require any laws. It just requires people to take a little bit more efficacy.
John Gere.
You know, I think there's reasons to be optimistic about it. Certainly as the current generation, or the youngest that is, are so into their handhelds and phones, smartphones, et cetera, that they may be able to make use more of this. But even if, in fact, it turns out only a small subset of people make use of it, the fact is you get more information out there, and it might, in fact, change the kind of media coverage that goes on and the kinds of stories that are written, that it could, in fact, change the narrative of the campaign because we have more investigation going on about all the various claims. So anytime you have a chance to put more information out there, even if, in fact, it's not going to be digested by every single American right away, we certainly have to seize it with both hands.
Well, perfect place to end. Thank you, all three of you, so very much. Kathleen Hall Jamison is professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Jamison helped to create factcheck.org and flackcheck.org. Michael Franz is professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads. Also with us is John Gere. He is professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.